Thank you. I am not new here. I was here 10 years ago, so I really feel like I've come back home. I was here for a whole month at the Wittgenstein Archives. I didn't know many people, but I met a few here at the philosophy department. So this is really like coming back and beginning all over again. Very exciting for me. And in the 2 days that I've been here, 1.5 days, I've already had some conversations with people, and I already realized that everything I say is so context-dependent that I probably will not change my talk, but I think that through discussion, things will probably change. The main point, and this is for this talk, I don't know about Wittgenstein, I don't think Wittgenstein changes context-wise, but human rights, talking about human rights, and especially talking about religion, is for me context-dependent, context being either Israel, Israel-Palestine, or the United States. And from what I've gathered from discussions already, I don't know about human rights, but religion is very different here, or any talk of religion is very different here in Norway, and I guess in general here in Europe. So I just am warning or apologizing ahead of time that this might sound to you very American, perhaps even Israeli. That's one point. Another point, you asked about the title. The title, we said human rights and religion because that is the general umbrella under which I worry usually. But the exact title is The Sacred and the Humane. And it was actually the title that I gave a paper that I wrote 1.5 years ago. The paper was published in 2 different venues, the exact same paper, and the exact same paper, which I will read in a moment. It was published both in the New York Times and on a website of the National Humanities Center in North Carolina. The National Humanities Center prides itself on being a very highfalutin, sophisticated academic research institute. The New York Times prides itself on very other things, definitely not being academic. In the New York Times, the paper got 200 and something comments, some very livid comments, some very polemic comments, some arguing, some cheering me on. It was a journalism issue. On the website of the National Humanities Center, on the other hand, they edit the responses. In fact, they solicit responses from philosophers or academics. Not philosophers, but humanities. Not necessarily philosophers, in fact, but humanities. And there were, I guess, 9 or 10 replies, well thought out, well argued, some well argued replies, which then persuaded me to respond to the replies. And in fact, there was a conversation going there. So what I want to do here today is actually present the whole thing, not the New York Times, but the Research Center's discussion. I want to actually try a new exercise in presenting papers. Instead of just presenting my own article, I want to then give voice to some of the people who replied, and then have my own voice come back if possible. And then I guess that will be the trigger to what we talk about. I hope it'll be invigorating rather than just shutting us up because maybe those guys said everything that we want to say. I doubt it, especially as I said before, because this context is so different. So I'm going to start the conversation just by reading my original article and telling you about what other people had said about it. Okay, human rights are all the rage. They have become currently a very popular arena for both political activism and rampant discourse. Human rights, as we all know, are the rights humans are due simply by virtue of being human, and I treat that as a definition. We can then talk about that, but that is the definition. Not the foundation, not the discussion, not the argument for, but the definition of human rights. Rights that are due simply by virtue of being human. There's nothing simple here, since both human and rights are concepts in need of investigation. Now, one deep philosophical issue that invigorates debates in human rights is the question of their foundations and their justification. The question, where do human rights come from? What grounds them? That is the main question that I usually teach for a whole semester in a course called The Philosophy of Human Rights. Not the legal aspects, not the political aspects, but rather the philosophy of human rights. Where do they come from and what grounds them? There are two essentially different approaches in answering that question, the religious way and the secular or philosophical way. So I'm being very one-minded here, single-minded here. You either give a religious answer or a secular philosophical answer to where do they come from and what grounds them. Writing in the New York Times Magazine in 1993, Ronald Dworkin, in an article called Life is Sacred, That's the Easy Part, said very succinctly the following, quote, "We almost all accept that human life in all its forms is sacred, that it has intrinsic and objective value quite apart from any value it might have to the person whose life it is. For some of us, this is a matter of religious faith, for others, of secular but deep philosophical belief." I love that semantics, and we'll talk about it. What is he saying here? Something religious or something secular? For some of us, it is religious faith. For others, it's deep philosophical belief. What is deep philosophical belief? What role does that word play there? A good representative of the first camp, the religious camp, is the religious historian R.H. Taney, who said the following, quote, "The essence of all morality is this, to believe that every human being is of infinite importance and therefore that no consideration of expediency can justify the oppression of one by another. But to believe this, it is necessary to believe in God," end of quote. The second non-religious grounding of human rights, I think, is harder to give voice to by a single representative, since there's a multiplicity of distinct non-religious groundings of human rights. Think again of Dworkin's words that I read out a second ago. We all accept, he says, that human life is sacred. By using that word, sacred, he seems to have already put the ball in the religious field. Human life is sacred. That field, the field of the sacred as opposed to the mundane, plays a straightforward game, claiming that the only possible answer to the question of the foundation of human rights is the religious answer. Only by positing a divine creator of everything, including human beings, can we give a satisfactory account of the sacredness of human beings, of why we deserve or are entitled to something that derives from our being just that, sacred human beings. On this view, any highfalutin philosophical concept that is called upon to be a comparable base for human rights is no more than religious foundation clothed in secular garb. It's really just God by any other name. In a recent book called The Idea of Human Rights, Michael Perry is unequivocal about the worthlessness of the secular bunch. It was a very important book. Michael Perry has since then intimated to me that it's not his latest thought and that he's changed his thought. But this was a book that came out in 98, and we all thought we had to use it in our courses, The Idea of Human Rights. His point was that it is always religious, whether you admit it or not. And the way he puts it is the following, quote, "There is finally no intelligible, much less persuasive secular version of the conviction that every human being is sacred. The only intelligible versions are religious." End of quote. Now think of conspicuous elements in the vocabulary of human rights. There's the notion of dignity, inviolable, end in himself. I can think of so many concepts that come up when we talk about human rights. Although we try to give them meaning and standing without a turn to religious essence, these terms hold no secular water, according to thinkers like Perry. There can be no human dignity, no inviolable person, no end in herself, without the supposition of the human as sacred, and therefore as a godly creation. Okay, so this is the religious side, saying that our vocabulary is a show behind which you have to talk about God. And Dworkin is my paradigm example, human life is sacred. Why does he need to use the word sacred? They are saying that even dignity, inviolable, and in herself, all of those are also actually religious. I think that there is no philosophically robust reason to accept this claim. True, the religious answer is straightforward and clear-cut. True, philosophical theorizing on the foundations of human rights in particular and morality in general may be complex or nuanced or even convoluted. True, the word sacred carries religious connotations. But that could just be a manner of speaking. And dignity and inviolability certainly do not need to be tied down to the sacred. Aristotelian virtue, natural justice, the Kantian categorical imperative arising from reason, of course, all of these offer bases for morality at large. Theories of human needs, human interests, human agency provide analytical foundations for the idea of human rights. And then there is, for instance, Hart's one natural right, the equal right to be free. Gewirth's turn to human action and logic. Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum's talk of basic human capabilities, and oh, so many others, all affording humanistic starting points for human dignity at the base of human rights that need nary a wink at religion. There's also a legitimate and, to my mind, strong critique of the individualism that guides the liberal idea of human rights and that enjoins us to rethink our mantras regarding the autonomous self who is the human. That these are intricate and sometimes problematic, that they might be in tension with, even contradict each other, that we must do considerable analytic and philosophical work in their explanation, does not cancel out their equal profundity, equal to religion, that is, in justifying human rights. So I'm saying, and this might be considered offensive by certain religious thinkers, that the religious answer is more straightforward. The philosophical answer is more complex, perhaps even convoluted, but it doesn't make it less deep, less profound. Perhaps we need to do more work on it. What difference does it make? Beyond the theoretical discussions on human rights, questions like what grounds them theoretically, what justifies them theoretically, what legal implications do they carry theoretically, there is always the so what question. Why do we care, or why should we care, if the practice of human rights is born of religious or secular motivation? Well, take a look on how we work on the ground, and I think I should have said right at the beginning that my original thoughts of human rights came from practice rather than theory. I was involved in human rights for, I guess, 3 decades before I finally got to thinking about it as an academic or intellectual pursuit. That was 12 years ago. I can tell you the date exactly when it became a research issue rather than just running over the hillsides, as we call it in Israel. Okay, so take a look at how we work on the ground, so to speak. Look at how we do human rights, for example, in Israel-Palestine. When Rabbi Arik Asherman, the leader of an organization called Rabbis for Human Rights in Israel, squats in the mud trying to stop soldiers who have come to set a blockade around a village, or fight settlers who have come to uproot olive trees, as he has done so often in villages like Yanun and Jamain and Bidu in the last decade. When he does this along with me, I'm from B'Tselem, the Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. Or he does it with a group of secular kids from an organization called Anarchists Against the Wall. Or people from the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And he does this on a Friday afternoon, knowing full well that he might be courting religious transgression should the Sabbath arrive. Does it matter that his reasons for doing so spring from his faith, while the anarchists derive from their secular political worldview, and B'Tselem and the Committee Against House Demolitions derive from secular international human rights law? So I come from human rights law, the anarchists come from being against anything, and he comes from the Old Testament. The end product, the human rights activity, is similar, even identical. But the reason, the intention, the motivation for it are distinctly different. Does that matter? I think it does. I dare say that religion, even when indirectly in the service of human rights, is not really working for human rights. I'll repeat that sentence because I don't want it to sound offensive. Maybe if I repeat it, it'll get weaker. I dare say that religion, even when indirectly in the service of human rights, is not really working for human rights. Although there is recognition of the human as sacred, it is not the concept of rights that propels the religious person. For him, the human status of sacredness draws from divine creation and directive. For man, and sometimes woman, having been created in God's image, and therefore has nothing to do with a human right. Jack Donnelly, in a book called Universal Human Rights in Theory and Practice, says the following, quote, "Traditional societies typically have had elaborate systems of duties, conceptions of justice, political legitimacy, human flourishing that sought to realize human dignity. Flourishing or well-being entirely independent of human rights. These institutions and practices are alternative to, rather than different formulations of, human rights." These are Donnelly's words, which I do adopt here. The question we have seen is what functions as the source of moral authority, assuming that human rights are morally based. Hilary Putnam, in his latest book called Jewish Philosophy as a Guide to Life, I got to tell you something about this book. It's called Jewish Philosophy as a Guide to Life. It's about Levinas, Rosenzweig, and Buber, and a little bit of Wittgenstein. And Putnam says that originally he thought to call it 3.5 Jews. but then he changed the title and called it Jewish Philosophy as a Guide to Life. He says it beautifully, quote, "Every human being should experience him herself as commanded to be available to the neediness, the suffering, the vulnerability of the other person," end of quote. But notice Putnam's terminology. Commanded. Every human being should experience himself as commanded to be these things. Who commands us? The question boils down to who or what is the source of moral authority? God or the human being? Religion or ethics? I want to say that that makes a great difference. And I want to ask, if we, the religious person and the secular person, end up engaging in the same activity and also, more so, do it by thinking of ourselves as available to another's neediness, why does it make a difference? The problem arises not when we act together, but rather when we don't. Or put differently, when we act together, the problem stays in the realm of theory, providing fodder for the philosophical game of human rights. It is when we disagree about abortion, about capital punishment, about settling occupied lands, that the religious authority must vacate the arena of human rights. This is not to say that all religious people hold the same views on these issues or that secular persons are always in agreement. Although opinion polls, by the way, for whatever they're worth, point to far more unity of thought on the religious side. It is rather that an internal secular debate on issues that pertain to human rights is structurally and essentially different from the debate between the two camps. In the latter, the debate between two camps, religious and secular camps, the authority that is conscripted to command, as Putnam said, to command us on the religious side is God, while on the secular side, it is the human, with her claim to reason, her proclivity to emotion, and her capacity for compassion. In a sense, that is no commandment at all. It is a turn to the human and a perhaps axiomatic, perhaps even dogmatic posit of human dignity that turns the engine of human rights, leaving us open to discussion, disagreement, and questioning without ever vacating or deserting that first posit, human dignity. The parallel turn to God puts our actions under his command. If he commands a violation of human rights, then so be it. There's no meaning to human rights under divine commandment. A deep acceptance of divine authority, and that is what true religion demands, entails a renunciation of human rights, if God so wills. Had God's angel failed to call out, "Abraham, Abraham," Abraham would have slain Isaac. And that's Kierkegaard, which I don't go into here. There might seem to be a dogmatic anti-religiosity arising from my reluctance to admit religion as a legitimate player in the human rights game. I've been using religion all along in, you might say, a very conservative, traditional way. Philosophers of religion and anthropologists have opened up the study of religion to recognize a variety of other ways of saying religion. Religious experience, religion as a form of life, religion as a cultural framework, religion as a system of symbols, a religious phenomenology, etc. We have all of that in philosophy of religion. Adopting a certain view on religion or a specific definition of religion is hugely pertinent to how one sees human rights functioning in the religious context. Let me then make explicit the definition of religion at the root of my unrest. Religion is a system of myth and ritual. It is a communal system of propositional attitudes, beliefs, hopes, fears, desires that are related to superhuman agents. This very common definition, by the way, has been recognized as the Dartmouth School in philosophy of religion, and that's their wording. Along with several essential terms here, myth, ritual, communal, propositional, but the important point is that it asserts the unconditional superhuman agents, in other words, God, that are necessary for the divorce I espouse between religion and human rights. Other perceptions of religion that are godless would not perhaps suffer the same fate. And you may say, what about the wonder of religion, the majestic awe that encompasses the religious person when confronted by a spiritual revelation that motivates and regulates for in all his life? This was Wittgenstein's definition of religion. It's something that regulates for in all his life. Can secular morals live up to that type of enchantment? Is there not something about secular rationalism that conduces rather to skepticism, fallibility, and indifference than to the kind of awesome respect for the sacred human being that comes with religion? Here I have no choice than to turn to dogmatism. Call it Kantian dogmatism. And this is Kant, of course, saying, two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe. The more often and steadily we reflect upon them, the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. That was Kant, not me. For some, the physics that runs the natural world and the ethics that provide for our moral sense are seen to be more ordinary than religious experience. I, on the other hand, can think of nothing more awe-inspiring than humanity and its fragility and its resilience. So that was my article. Now I have the second half?
Yes,
I have time?
Absolutely.
Okay. So that was the original article. The first response to come through the pipeline, and I dare say the response that I was waiting for, that I have discussed often in classes in philosophy of religion, and that I find to be sometimes important and at other times facetious, was the following. This article, said the respondent, is, quote, based on a caricature of religion, one that admittedly many who are religious, and he put religious in scare quotes, perpetuate. The responder goes on to say that religion should not be thought of as supernatural agents commanding for the sake of reward. Instead, it should be considered, and this is again his words, more like artistic traditions. Even in the midst of their ugly histories, there are strands within the history of religions that are traditions of thinking of all that is possible for the human being, especially in terms of love, compassion, and forgiveness. Much like an artist engages and practices to be a particular kind of artist, the point of the religious is to engage in practices in the hope of experiencing an imminent transcendence. End of quote. There are two important points in this accusation of caricature. One, of course, denies the assumption behind my idea that religion has to do with supernatural agents. It's not my idea, it's the Dartmouth School, and I'll say a bit more about it in a minute. The other, again, of course, denies that religion is all ugly history and looks to the positive strands in that history that center on, as he said, love, compassion, and forgiveness. These are indirectly related and both deserve more treatment. Choosing to focus on, for want of a better name, the Dartmouth School definition of religion and emphasizing that choice, I hope to do something far removed from caricaturing religion. I hoped rather to insist that the account of religion that is necessary for my argument involves a transcendent being, usually considered omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent, also known as God. Obviously, there are other definitions of religion, but this one, beyond serving my argument, is, I believe, the most common one, if not for theologians and philosophers, then definitely for the religious person. In fact, one of my favorite versions of philosophical thought on religion, very different from the common one that I'm talking about now, is Wittgenstein's, where religion is perceived, according to some interpreters, as a language game or a form of life, and belief in God is emptied of its propositional content. So we don't have time to go into Wittgenstein on religion here, but Wittgenstein definitely denies anything that the Dartmouth School says. He says it's not propositional attitudes, it's not beliefs and propositions of God existing or things like that. It is a form of life, or as Wittgenstein says, a way of living. But one of the principal critiques of Wittgenstein's fascinating, original, non-standard understanding of religion is that he's not speaking for or of the really religious person, since religious persons, by and large, proclaim a belief in a transcendent being. And one would expect us philosophers to be attuned to what ordinary religious people say. Notice that that first complaint that I read out put religious in scare quotes, and that seems to be somewhat scornful of these ordinary religious people. As another responder notices, it is somewhat ingenuous to suppose that real religious people are more sophisticated thinkers than those who are derided as religious in scare quotes. Okay, so what is it to be a real religious person? Now, the second thought, invigorating the idea of the balance between the ugly history of religion and its more benevolent symptoms, and finding for the ugly history, is more an historical diatribe than a caricature, and I didn't use it in my article. But I always wonder what we should say when we talk about the ugly history of religion. In what way can we really agree with Tawney, said one of the responders, that the, quote, essence of all morality is to believe that every human being is of infinite importance, and that belief in God generates this commendable belief? Well, if we look at scripture closely, and we're talking here of the Abrahamic religions, we would have to, as the responder said, tortuously extrapolate benevolence. I don't know how many people here are biblical scholars or religious interpreters, so I hope we can talk about that. I love that expression. We have to tortuously extrapolate benevolence out of scripture. More so, says that responder, the behavior and practices of the religious both throughout history and today reveal the true function of religion everywhere. That function is to divide human beings one against another, to place one person above another based upon false or faulty premises. This is the responder, not me. I'm wondering how much of this we can accept. Let me try to connect the two, the ugly history and the real caricature about religion believing in God. Giving up on the requirement of transcendent being for calling something religion would make many other cultural phenomena religions. And I think we would lose much by doing so. Now, this doesn't mean that I deny aspects of religiosity other than the insistence on a transcendent being. That a religious tradition might also be an artistic one, but so could a non-religious one, does not contradict the core demand that it hold recognition of a transcendent being. Neither does the acknowledgement of the human as being capable of love, compassion, or forgiveness. But like that second respondent, I admit to being stumped by the concept of immanent transcendence. Upon examination, says that respondent, it always seems that things like immanent transcendence are either mumbo-jumbo inexplicable in plain English, once more allowing the religious thinker to think himself above lesser mortals, or are activities, thought patterns, or emotions equally attainable by any thoughtful secular person, but without the ill-defined mystical language. End of respondent quote. I think I would say it less stridently. If it is transcendent, then it is not humanly immanent or imminently human. By transcendent, I mean exactly beyond human reach or possibility. I believe that that is the conventional use of the word, and I believe that is the ordinary use of the word, and that is what conventionally religious people say. A somewhat different track, but following the same idea in general, was taken by someone who agreed with me, but put more into my words than I had put in myself. He made note that we should engage in a, quote, careful discussion of the dangers of a God-centered system of ethics. If only high school and college history teachers would highlight the destruction and inhumanity visited on others since ancient Sumer, we might not be facing the sad prospect of a national election revolving around God's will. This is in the U.S., of course. When we finally figure out that it is humanity that is sacred and not some special group or scripture, we will all be safer and happier. And then he mentions a book, by the way, that I didn't know, by Zuckerman, called Society Without God, based on his year-long study of Danes and Swedes. He doesn't say Norwegians. Okay, but there is a family there. We should all be free to conceive of ultimate being in whatever way we wish. Political and ethical behavior, however, should always be based on the fundamental rights of all humans as members of the same family. End of quote. This brings up an issue which I didn't have time or space to address, but it is supremely important. There's obviously a difference between the subjective, personal, religious belief of the faithful and the religious institutions that organize these faithful and their actions. One can talk about the behavior of religious individuals, or more amorphously, about the practice of religion. The issue I did not, but I would like to discuss, is that of the behavior and practices of religious institutions. I agree that these institutions have been responsible for division and wars throughout history. Again, this is not to say that secular communities have been devoid of division, conflict, and wars throughout history. I would, however, go as far as to say that it is the very essence of a godly religion expressed in its sacred texts that gives rise to and occasions such characteristic institutional behaviors. Of course, one can choose to emphasize the more humane expressions in sacred texts. But A, these are precisely the locales in these texts that are not God-centered. And B, even if they are, the choice of specific texts as opposed to others is a matter of human interpretation. In other words, it is the theoretical core of religion that entails the kind of religious practice which holds the potential of violating human rights. Only one or two more points that were brought up in discussion, and then I'll finish. Some commentators challenged me on theological issues or interpretive conundrums, but I never purported to delve deeply into either. Neither do I deny that the canonical religious texts have multifarious readings. So yes, one could say that all persons are of equal value in God's eyes, as some challenged, but one could just as validly ask why some are chosen while others are not. I can't make snide remarks now about what the chosen people are doing as we speak. The relevant dare was that human beings are of value not because they were created in God's image, but because they were a godly creation of love. The evidence for this respondent was all from the New Testament, so I really can't pretend to know it well. The creation of man and woman in God's image is intimately connected with human rights in the following way. When searching for a universal grounding of human rights, it is generally recognized that human dignity provides the grounding. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which has been called our Bible, by the way, by Elie Wiesel, I think. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights begins with the words, recognition of the inherent dignity of all members of the human family. And any other treaty or document that has come out in the human rights community always puts human dignity there as the basis. For the religious foundationalist of human rights, it is precisely creation in the image of God that roots such inherent dignity. And even, I see this is even in the Catholic Church, sorry. The dignity, this is from the Catholic Catechism, says, the dignity of the human person is rooted in his creation in the image and likeness of God. So this is not just the Jewish tradition as I had thought. This is really in religion in general. So close is the relationship between dignity and creation in the image of God that in the Hebrew tradition, the expression in the image of God, B'Tselem Elohim, has acquired a non-literal meaning. It signifies dignity. Saying in ordinary Hebrew parlance that one was created in the image of God is tantamount to saying one has dignity. Or as is more often the case, saying that one has lost the image of God amounts to saying that one has lost all dignity. Not surprisingly, a leading Israeli human rights organization, and I should say that I was chair of the organization, so I'm biased, but this leading human rights organization is called B'Tselem. And B'Tselem just means in the image of. The philosopher of language can be fascinated by the creation of meaningful names that is exhibited by this case. The word B'Tselem in Hebrew, one word for the English foursome, in the image of, is as inappropriate a proper noun, a name, as in the image of would be in English. In 1989, think of an organization called In the Image Of. In 1989, upon its establishment, it sounded odd, even awkward, to name an organization In the Image Of. Today, over 23 years later, it functions easily as a proper name for a human rights organization, with no thought to its genesis in the story of human creation in Genesis. But that instance of meaning as use is another philosophical story. Finally, and I think most importantly, a doctoral student of theology and philosophy was worried about what I had said. According to him, I, quote, portray religious human rights as alienated from our humanity since they are in some sense dependent on God, whereas secular human rights are more intimately connected with our humanity. That same person articulated a deep concern that, quote, while Beletsky frames her essay as an exploration of what grounds or explains human rights, she ends up by saying that there isn't really a foundation at all, rather an axiomatic, perhaps even dogmatic reflection, and these are my words, on humanity and its fragility and its resilience. And that, he says, is what gets human rights off the ground for me, being axiomatic and dogmatic. Okay, he goes on. I won't read everything that he says, but he doesn't like the fact that I'm dogmatic. He says, if our human rights theory is so impoverished, it's a deep mystery how we are to go on with our discussion, disagreement, and questioning about human rights. If all we can point to when explaining human rights is our mere humanity, then what sets the ground rules for the discussion? What will determine whether this or that is a human right or no right at all? Without answers to these questions, we don't have a theory of human rights at all. And I think this was a very serious accusation. Let me have the last word. I don't know how strong it is. Most significant for me, and contrary to this perception that I just presented, is exactly my insistence on the richness of the secular conversation on human rights. That it is a questioning, positing, or even critique of the foundations for human rights does not impoverish or empty it of deep meaning. The use of dogmatic is indeed foundational, to the tune of Wittgenstein's My Spade is Turned. And again, contrary to the perception of mere humanity, it is precisely the humanistic bedrock that inspires the kind of awe usually reserved for the divine. Sad descriptions of the contextualized condition of humanity, as given by some of the commentators, might indeed refute such awe. It is important, therefore, to distinguish between talk about the having of rights, a normative statement, and reports of their implementation or violation by states and communities, a descriptive account. Putting this all consistently, one might then have to confess only to the awe inspired by humanity's normative potential. Thank you.